Welcome to Polish Media Agenda Talks. I'm Bart Kamarts, for those who don't know me. I'm Associate Professor in the Department of Media Communication here at the LSE, and I'm happy to welcome Rebecca Skelet to our series. Let me introduce Rebecca. She's a Senior Program Manager at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and she also manages the Strong Cities Network, and this is a network, a global network formed of 62 cities across about 40 countries, consisting of mayors, municipal policymakers, and practitioners that are united in building social cohesion and community resilience to counter violent extremism. And as such, the topic of her talk also deals with the networks of extremism that we see emerging in across the world, and also with how to counter radicalization, how to counter extremism and foster political socialization. Previously, Rebecca worked on the front line, so to speak, in UK's countering violent extremism across several London boroughs, and she also has extensive experience in developing counter-violence extremism programs and policy frameworks. And she's also a member of the UK Department for Education's Expert Advisory Panel on Extremism. So without further ado, let me give you the floor.
Great. Thanks for having me. Hi, so thanks so much for the introduction and for having me here today. I am going to assume a general knowledge in some of the terms that were referenced in that nice bio that was read out. So extremism, radicalization, terrorism, all these buzzwords can be rather convoluting and are often used interchangeably in a way that isn't particularly helpful. So we'll try and address some of those nuances today. And I want to just start by giving a bit of background to the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And I don't know if those of you have heard of us before, but we've got a 15-year track record of kind of being at the forefront of challenging extremism, creating networks and programs that look at the underlying grievances that might fuel radicalization, might fuel terrorism. And we've done that through a few different areas. We're kind of a think tank, but actually we're also a do tank. And by that, I mean we do local, granular work with civil society groups on the kind of bottom stream of our work. But on a top level, we also do work with governments. We do work with multilateral groups, such as, say, the United Nations. And actually, that's where my network was launched last year. So I manage the Strong Cities Network, and there was a bit of an introduction to what that network is. But essentially, it's the first ever global network to look at how we can strengthen the practices of those on the front line who are in the center points of communities to challenge extremism. And actually, those individuals are constantly on the front line for every social issue that we look at. And they're almost coming to terms now that they have to play a role in countering terrorism too. And I think we can think of many incidences over the last decade, if not the last year, that might explain why that's so important. And so without further ado, I kind of want to hit the heart of the topic that I want to talk to you about. So why do people join violent extremist movements, and how can we counter those processes? And there's a few symbols on the board behind me to give you an idea of the continuum and the spectrum of extremism that I will refer to as violent extremism today, and one that particularly springs to mind for some of the interesting debates taking place at the moment is FARC and the current fall of the peace deal in Colombia, which is hopefully something that you've all been following. But certainly on this kind of continuum of symbols that you can see, there has been a significant rise in white power movements over the last 2 to 3 years in this country, across Europe, and also across America. There's different definitions of where some of these groups fall into when we're thinking about how countries judge their own domestic terrorism groups, but also their international groups. For example, there are no neo-Nazi groups that are listed on prescribed terrorist groups by the US or by the UK, which is significantly problematic when we're trying to create an environment where we can challenge all forms of extremism, which is at the heart of what the Institute does. But before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty of why terrorist groups exist? Why do they recruit people? How do they do that? It's kind of getting to the nitty bit of the question that I find so interesting, which is kind of more about who we are and the idea of how do we politically socialize ourselves in the world. And I always like to start off by giving you an idea of where I stand in the world. So I don't sound it, but I'm Scottish. I have mixed feelings about the second referendum that's about to take place between Scotland following Brexit. I would say I'm a liberal lefty who doesn't support Labour currently, but would probably still vote for them. I like running. So that shapes my view on the world. And you all have something that is independently important to you, whether or not it's to do with where you're from, where you're going, what you currently do. And when those aspects of who we are challenged, we have to respond, right? When these things that we hold dear to us, when our values are challenged, there is a duty upon us, if we feel as attached to them as we hold them to be true in our identity, to respond to them. And sometimes violence is a response. And not to say that all violence is just, far from it. It's just these are the trigger points by which we might seek to make a statement on behalf of something we want to protect. And I think it's important that we look at some forms of extremism in that sense. So when we first start thinking through extremism, I think the first and most important point to make is that this is not a new phenomenon. Actually, it's so far from it. And there's two examples of groups there that are still heavily in existence. The Ku Klux Klan on the top there. There is every year an attempt by a member of the KKK in Alabama to stand for a local councillor role in a municipality. You know, they are a legal group that operate within the Freedom of Expression and the Civil Liberties Act in the US. I find that troubling. The IRA is still very much in existence. And, you know, only 2 years ago did they send 20-odd letter bombs to various postal offices across England and Wales. You know, they still pose a significant threat. And the way I like to try and understand extremism, and we will, I'm sure, in the questions get into some of the complexity around these terms, but I like this quote very much from Robert F. Kennedy, and I always come back to it whenever I feel challenged on my own views on this topic, and that is, what is objectionable, what is dangerous about extremists is not that they are extreme, but that they are intolerant. And the evil is not what they say about their cause, but what they say about their opponents. And actually, where we are right now in the world and the current extremist rhetoric, we have two main themes. And one is the uprising of neo-Nazi white supremacist movements that have designed their modus of operations to be focused on anti-Islamic causes. And they have evolved to responding to that threat. On the other hand, that reciprocally radicalizes or further radicalizes so-called Islamic extremist groups. And I personally can't stand that term. I think it's part of the problem of a lot of work in this area of work. I'd prefer to call them Daesh-inspired or Al-Qaeda-inspired or Boko Haram-inspired, depending on where you are in the world. And that's, I think, important for you to know my kind of ethics on this work. So when we're thinking about radicalization, you know, what do we really mean? That term is often thrown around, and I don't think we often stop to pause and consider the impact of the term or what it's seeking to achieve. There's no single route in or out of extremism, and that's very much commonly accepted now by academics, politicians, practitioners, and we as the Institute fundamentally believe that. But we do know that there are a few things that might make up somebody's journey into supporting violent extremism or making an act in its name. They could include some background factors, such as some of those things I mentioned before, your identity, where you're from, what things you hold dear. They can be influential factors, which could be a mixture of the press, your education system, who you know, who's trying to get to know you. And that's important in terms of thinking through the importance of the internet in this space, as well as ideological factors. And I think within ideology, there's a few different schools of thought on what you can put under the ideological umbrella and what you can't. But certainly, there are many, many groups that are using very advanced propaganda techniques to try and put forward a story and a narrative that speaks to people and makes them act in ways that are not only divisive for society, but pose significant dangers to not only threats to life, but threats to, I guess, values. And that's where some of this work is particularly challenging. When we're looking at individuals who are radicalized, generally speaking, across the globe, there is a kind of common knowledge that there's either a high level of risk, a medium level of risk, or a low level of risk. So when we're thinking about a low level of risk, we're thinking about people who are already in that narrative of hate, who are encouraging intolerance. And I kind of ask you in the question, are these people that we should be considering as being within the plethora of violent extremism supporters, or are they individuals who are expressing hate and intolerance in a very normal way for democratic societies? Being Scottish, I have been brought up to have a very specific view on the English, as every Scottish lassie will be raised to think. Is that intolerance at some level? Is that something that we should be worried about, or is this just a normal part of who we are and what makes us view the world? When we're looking at medium risk, we're thinking about people who are engaged, who are already on that journey somehow. Individuals who might have liked a group on Facebook, say like the EDL. We're also thinking about people who are supportive of, say, Daesh and foreign fighters. Again, I ask you the question, are these people that we should be concerned about? Is there a duty of the state and society to look at ways to prevent these people from moving up the ladder to a high-risk category? And I think yes, I think we should be. I think these are things that we need to be conscious and mindful of for a variety of different reasons that we'll hopefully get into some more detail on today. And then you've got high-risk individuals who have access to the capabilities, who have the knowledge, the know-how, the intent, who have such innate and deep-down hatred and such a view on what the world should be that they're willing to do anything to make their vision of society come true. And I think most terrorism has political roots. I don't think it's ever got religious roots. I think it's all about somebody's identity, but certainly not all the world would agree with me on that. So I know through the network that I manage that there's a number of different ways that this spectrum of risk plays out in the world, and that can include a number of law enforcement responses that I don't think many of us in the room would be comfortable with. So that's the continuum. There's a couple of theories that are useful if you want to look into this further. I've put on Maslow's hierarchy of need with an addition at the bottom that was done by a child in a school in Islington where I used to work, because I think that is the Wi-Fi is now the baseline of, you know, what we do and how we think the world is. But in terms of the theory that kind of shaped a lot of violent extremism work, it's Mogadam's staircase. And I suggest looking into it in some detail if you're interested in studying this topic. But there is obviously parallels to be made with Maslow's approach to looking at self-actualization. And Mogadam's almost replaced that with a view of terrorism being a form of self-actualization. None of these models are great. None of them really work for every single person. But you can certainly see the complexity of the field when we look at Mogadam's staircase in the colored triangle. So you have unhappy people in society who are looking for justice, who get frustrated, who seek like-minded individuals, and then all of a sudden radicalization is just thrown in as a term. And actually, I can think of many people who are like-minded individuals or groups who are frustrated looking for justice, who are unhappy in society, who aren't radicalized. So this is where some of these models are quite poor in practice. But certainly, it tries to show a continuum. It tries to rationalize why it is that individuals with a series of different lives, with a series of different mechanisms, can be sucked into something that we all kind of recognize as being bad for society, depending on where you're from in the world, that is. Then we add in the complexity and almost the sheer scale of where we are today in terms of recruitment around radicalization, and that's the online space. So over the last 5 to 10 years, I'd say we've seen a huge decrease in what I'd refer to here as static platforms that have been in operation for some time. So these are groups that could be, say, a side group operating in Ask FM, groups that are operating in the deep dark web. who might be affiliated with some of those mentioned here, like white power movements, either maybe Golden Dawn or Combat 18. You know, Combat 18 have had, a new renewed form of access to individuals who find themselves leaning towards white supremacy, white supremacist views that are also tailored with this idea that actually they need to have a resurgence now because of the threat of so-called Islamic extremism. And that is a very deeply disturbing aspect for individuals who work in my industry. And we know that had a fall in their memberships online, and there had been a big movement to try and disrupt white power networks. Some of you may be Chelsea supporters, and the infamous Chelsea Headhunters group were operating for some time, recruiting from the football club itself during matches. They're barred using a number of different law enforcement mechanisms on the ground around their access to individuals who considered that they were supporting the club by supporting a white supremacist group. But in reality, we also know that Twitter, Facebook, Ask.fm, you've got Snapchat, these are a variety of different platforms that are being abused on a daily basis by extremists. And we can take down material based on some of the user agreements that those sites might well have in place. But again, is that a good thing? I mean, the freedom of expression challenges that has are considerable. And I think that's something that hopefully we can get into a bit more detail. I'm going to speak a little bit about the online censorship movement shortly. But we certainly know that there is a significant use of online networks. And I don't think that will change anytime soon. And the other factor I want to really draw to your attention is mental health. So this is Michael Piggin's room. Michael Piggin was a young lad from Loughborough. He was found to have 10 bottles ready to be fueled up to cause massive attacks against local groups that weren't white. He really didn't really have a specific target in his mind, but he had a bedroom that looked like this. And I often find myself looking at this room and thinking, how on earth was he missed for so long? You've got, you know, not only do you have obviously a Nazi symbol, you also have a variety of different images of significant attacks that have taken place around the world posted up on his wall. You know, this guy was a fan and he had the capabilities and he was incited by groups, not just online, but he certainly found his self-actualization by considering making an attack in his local community. But he was found to have significant mental health issues, namely Asperger's, that again had been missed. So he'd been let down in society for that reason. He became so obsessed, which is what Asperger's can often do, and we actually see that as quite an interesting trend in some young, aspiring, radicalized, so-called radicalized. Can you be radicalized and have a mental health issue, or does one trump the other? Certainly, I think he's an interesting factor that we always have to remember, is that sometimes when we're thinking about groups online who are making significant attempts to target young, vulnerable people, often they find that they might have a relationship and might be able to build a narrative with those who are most vulnerable in society, like Michael Piggins. So the countering violent extremism area of work, it's a buzzword, and it includes many things. I wanted to share with you a rather complex slide at first glance, but it will make sense when I explain it, of some of the work that exists in this large space. So essentially, if we look at Mogadam's staircase in practice, if we lay that out on different contact points with society, you kind of see three phases. So if we're looking at the low risk, medium risk, high risk, for anybody who's got a public health background, you'll kind of see this as a kind of standard, you know, prevention at the bottom with targeted interventions at the top. So you have this continuum of an entry phase where that's where we know recruitment can take place. We know where the first point of contact can take place with a radical extremist group or a radical group if we want to challenge some of these concepts a bit more. And we know in that space that actually the best thing to do, based on looking at other forms of prevention, such as systems in place to tackle the recruitment of gangs, systems in place to try and raise awareness of CSE, child sexual exploitation in schools, we know that working on the front line, working with institutions, is a way of building that critical resilience in society to challenge propaganda when they see it, to challenge the notions of extremist groups suggesting that violence is an acceptable way to respond. And we also know that that work takes place in a variety of different ways quite effectively. Then you have the second phase, which is this kind of so-called belonging phase. And that's where actually some of the political socialization aspects of who and what make up us and our view in society can be played out in a bit more detail. So, for example, in the prison system, programs around rehabilitation are now often considered as part of the violent extremism solution to TACT offenders, which is the legislation in this country. But there's many, many schemes of individuals around the world using interventions in prisons to try and get to a stage of reducing someone's vulnerability to rejoining a terrorist group on their exit from prison. And then you have the kind of top phase for high-risk individuals, the exit phase. So the term de-radicalization essentially speaks to this idea that actually all you need to do is poke a seed of doubt in an individual who is committed to a terrorist organization. And I can talk at that with some detail, but I would probably say that for questions. So I want to move on, conscious of time, to discussing some of the networks that are in place to help mobilize this granular community-led response. And ISD run a number of networks, and it's the Strong Cities Network that we've already mentioned, but we also run a network called YouthCan, which is our youth civil activism network. And what we do with YouthCan is build up a level of young people from different areas of the world to look at how to challenge hate and division in their own society by using communication methods. So that could be campaigns that are aimed at trying to open people's eyes to how individuals are recruited to radicalization through them and us narratives. So I don't have any examples with me, sadly, but I can certainly speak to one that I particularly like that's about to roll out in the UK about Brexit. And young people recently met in London to design with creatives and with the support of YouTube and Google a response to look at how some of the narratives around Brexit have been incredibly dichotomous and have also caused a huge amount of division, which some of you may well feel yourselves, and with many of you being international in society, this them and us fear. Do we belong if we're not British? Those are some of the scaremongering that's been taking place on the ground, I think, pre and post-Brexit. So this campaign that some young people are launching in London is based around trying to challenge this idea that there is one such thing as a Brit. And one of the other networks we have is a network of formers and survivors of extremism, because they are the most credible voices often to challenge and open up an intelligent dialogue on what it means to be radicalized and what it means to be impacted by terrorism. And we have over 300 formers in that group from all over the globe who use their experiences of being radicalized and exiting groups to try and show some light into the process. And also to echo some of the things I've been saying to you today about the complexity of terrorism and how actually sometimes it does feel like the only option. And often, if we don't have these networks in place who are able to robustly challenge in a credible way narratives that are out there for public consumption, particularly online, we're not really going to get anywhere to solving the problem. We've gone into some detail about the Strong Cities Network, but just as a kind of overview of the objectives of the group, what we seek to do is try and connect practitioners who are seeking to build these networks on the ground. So from cities in Cameroon to Kosovo, to Bosnia, to the United States, to Colombia, we have people who are connecting with each other to try and learn from some of the lessons that are being learned in different capacities to different forms of responses to terrorism. And we find that by connecting these groups with formers and survivors of terrorism, we're creating a resilience and an understanding that they can pass on to their communities in quite a dynamic way. We're also trying to empower them to really stand up and speak to law enforcement practices that might be taking place in their cities and in their countries as a way to lobby them for the need to consider alternative ways. Law enforcement is not going to solve the issue of violent extremism, and nor should it. And we also work with them to try and build some of the functionalities in civil society to respond to terrorism. And I think that in itself is a big gap in what's taking place on the ground, not just here in the UK, but in all parts of the world. And there are many types of these positive networks, the Strong Cities being one. So we have the counter-narrative network that I mentioned. We have groups that are forming themselves against extremism. We have prevention networks with psychologists who are looking at this with a specific in-group, out-group understanding of how alienation can lead to somebody having a tendency or a vulnerability to joining radicalized networks of individuals. we're looking at supportive networks. What's the role of mothers and parents here? What's the role of thinking through friends and family? And that's kind of some of our work in education. And there's also things like single cause issues that are important. So remembering, I can never say Shibrenica, particularly with a dry mouth. I should have grabbed my water. But in terms of those networks, they are trying to remind us on a yearly basis for us to look at what happens when extremism and violent extremism and division aren't challenged. And I think that the town in Bosnia and the genocide that took place there is a firm reminder of that. And we also look at influencer networks. We work quite heavily with academics and governments. And I'm going to go straight on to current and future trends, because I think this is where I want to kind of leave you on. We've given you quite a very light touch, hopefully, overview of the kind of sector. And there's some exciting work taking place. As an organisation, we're looking into doing interventions online, looking at how you can actually engage with somebody on a one-to-one basis, using formers and survivors of extremism to challenge individuals who are inciting hate and inciting division online across all forms of extremism. We're also looking to try and shape the conversation that's taking place around censorship online. In Britain, we don't necessarily have the same freedom of expression rights as you might do as an American, but equally the same servers that shape and hold content that are used by extremists are all over the world, and there is no policing, really, to use that word as a kind of mindful caution for us to pick up on of these areas online. Should we be taking down material that we know incites hate? Should we be instead considering how individuals can make their own mind up and almost trusting society and audiences maybe a bit more than we do in other aspects of social intervention? And there's also a lot of work to mainstream our understanding of terrorism into a variety of different local structures. And I think you can see from work taking place in Australia to the US, there's an understanding that actually the role of teachers is specifically important in understanding and challenging hate at its first instance. Is that the right thing to do? And then lastly, we need to be really, really mindful that it's highly likely Mosul will fall in the next 3 to 6 months. And the current fighters there who are fighting for Daesh will be returning or will be trying to return. And some of them will need significant help to reintegrate, and some of them will need significant help from a de-radicalization perspective. And that's certainly something we need to be very mindful of. And I just want to make a quick word on censorship before we move into some Q&As. Just to give you a sense of scale of the problem online. So this is a stat just between October and December a couple of years ago in 2014, and that shows that there was 46,000 supportive accounts of ISIS. We know that when these individuals are taken down, it almost encourages the badge of honor phrase is up on the slide here, but that sense of pride that they are aggravating not only authorities, but their platforms, social media platforms like Twitter, enough to be taken down. And actually that's seen as a very attractive thing to individuals who are seeking to follow these users and will continue trying to find them. So you can see one account there that's saying the fifth account back again to spread the message of hack. Truth has come to smash Batil, which is not something I've read before, so apologies, not my slide. And also, you know, eighth account, I'm still going to keep spreading the truth. These are individuals who are certainly finding themselves almost a fan base on Twitter, and Twitter keep keeping them down. But that's just almost a temporary fix to a very long-term problem. But should we try and censor these platforms? And I'm not convinced. I keep finding myself on a continuum on that question. I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts. I want to show you this image and end on this. This is an image of a guy with a gun to his head. There's a man in a camo uniform. I want you to just have a little think about what your reaction to this image is and how this might affect different parts of the community on a global basis. And some of you may well have seen this image before. I certainly saw this bit of the image and when I first saw this in a course a few years ago. And I remember thinking, this is an example of all the negative aspects of the current war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it conjures a sense of injustice. It makes me feel quite uncomfortable, not just for our reasons for entering into the conflict zone there. But I also know that this would be read very differently from some of my friends in the community, say, in Leicester, in Bradford, in parts of the country that are certainly advocates of Stop the War solutions. But then you see the whole picture. And I think, you know, in thinking through what your role in your course is in CVE, in responding to terrorism, I really hope this hopefully showcases to you the importance of showing the whole picture. So you have the man with a gun to his head on one hand and also receiving some water. And I don't think that necessarily means that all of a sudden the picture's okay because at least the guy's hydrated. That's not the point I'm trying to make. However, I think we can be quite guarded in what we read in the media, and I think we often find ourselves with our prior conceptions and judgments and prejudices, seeing what we want to see. And actually, the best thing we can do is show the whole picture. And I think that's an important part of the work that we seek to do at the Institute. And so for closing points, not everyone is credible in this work. We have to find credible voices. I feel that formers and survivors are important in that role. You guys might have some ideas. And we must abide by the do no harm principle. And I hope that that's something that's not a foreign concept to any of you in the room, but certainly that's important for us in our work. We know that CVE, violent extremism work, is led best by non-government actors, that governments aren't always the best credible voice on this matter for a number of reasons, foreign policy being an important one. And lastly, you have a role in CVE, whether or not you fully see it and whether or not it's direct or not. But I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rebecca. Before I kind of open it up to the floor, I maybe have an opening question that, and we juggle a lot with these kind of concepts like terrorists or terrorism, radicalism, extremism. And obviously we know that one person's terrorist is the other person's freedom fighter. And there's also this kind of broader concept or problem with, yeah, sometimes there are certain nasty regimes where maybe violence might be justified. I mean, think of apartheid or kind of democratic struggles, etc., or the way in which Assad at this moment juxtaposes everybody that's against him as a terrorist. And similarly, with extremism and radicalism, we have a leader of the biggest opposition party in this country, which, according to some media, is constantly being framed as an extremist and a radical. And so I think the government is full of radicals, but so it's kind of like, or extremists for that matter. So there's kind of the slipperiness of these kind of concepts, and how do you deal as a practitioner with these kind of discussions and debates that you probably also get confronted with a
Absolutely.
Lot?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a real wing-dinger of a question, but to help try and convey a sense of, educated knowledge on this, I would say, firstly, governments are incredibly hypocritical in their use of these definitions. If we think about the current model of individuals going out to join Daesh as being almost the first thing that springs to mind for many when we think about terrorism, which isn't and shouldn't be the response, but it is, we should also bear in mind that actually the British were very supportive of sending individuals to fight in conflicts overseas. So, for example, thinking through the Spanish Revolution, if we want to go all the way back there, or thinking about the genocide in Bosnia. We had many individuals supported by the British government to go and take part in and fight regimes there. So this hypocrisy that is often shown on these definitions is unhelpful. However, you can kind of see why. Terrorism is very, very fluid. And I think when we're thinking about the continuum between terrorism and extremism, which is almost a definition that's used in favor of terrorism now, with extremism, the definition in this country anyway is around challenging British values, which I, as a Scot, take very big issue with. And so British values, you know, the rules of democracy, the rules of law, equality, human rights issues, that definition, if you challenge those values, you're an extremist, it's inherently flawed. But then if we look at how that concept is understood elsewhere in the world, actually extremism isn't really used as a buzzword in many of the cities and countries that I am working in. It's instead more about hate and division and what sows the seed of hate. And I think that's a healthier place for us to look at. And in terms of who is a terrorist and who is not, sadly, the law speaks for that. And if you go away from this lecture and have a look at proscribed groups in the UK, You may feel somewhat like me, that there's some obvious gaps in groups that are so-called prescribed terrorist groups in this country, and the same goes for in the US. And as a group, and as the kind of level of representation I do on behalf of cities, I take issue with that. And I advocate for that to be a much more unhypocritical, much more reflective and representative issue of what's taking place on the ground. The white supremacist, white power movement in the US poses so much more of a threat on the homeland than it does to anything else. But you don't see them illegal.
Hi, thanks a lot for the talk. I was wondering what your involvement is with the, or if any, with the government prevent strategy.
Yeah, sure.
And then on that, what sort of answers you have to some criticisms about the potential for it fueling extremism through alienation and profiling?
Absolutely. It's a really good question. So I used to work for the government's prevent strategy for about 3 years. I left shortly after the duty kicked in, not because I take issue with it, but I do take a bit of issue with it. There is certainly a really good debate taking place in this country around whether or not all the kind of programs I've kind of mentioned in my talk around CVE per se are causing more of an issue than solving it. And I know from experience that when that work is done well, it's done very well. And I can think of hundreds of people who I know would have been on a very different path than they are now if it wasn't for the good work of those in the front line. However, it's a big umbrella. That frontline work, working with individuals who are at risk, at that high risk level that I spoke about, is phenomenally needed. And it would be a travesty for that work to ever be criticized, and it is often criticized. And I do have a very different experience given my work in casework over the years. In terms of, is it helpful, for example, to have a prevent duty that applies to universities? I would be very interested to know what you guys think on that. But from a level of looking at how extremism plays out in different parts of society and the role of everybody in responding to that, I think that's a good step. I think in some way it's gone too far. I think in some way it's kind of entrenched upon much of our everyday public services in a way that maybe doesn't sit quite well with people. But it also does something that I think is often forgotten, and that is passing the responsibility from governments to respond to violent extremism to the front line, to the general population, to the public. And actually, in terms of individuals who are impacted by the prevent duty, in general, it's public sector workers. And I have very rarely met a public sector worker who's bigoted and who isn't a justice fighter and who isn't in that area of work to do the very best for the people that they're in contact with. So in terms of whether or not these things are counterproductive, I think it's always going to be hard to prove a negative, and that's essentially what CVE work does. But if we're moving the discussion away from law enforcement solutions down to granular frontline approaches, I think that is the only solution we can have to this issue. But I do absolutely agree that some of these things have gone too far, but it's not as simple as a black and white yes or no. I'd be interested to see what we say in 5 years' time.
Hi, thank you for coming. Regarding looking into policing the internet and censorship, you know, you referenced the differences in certain laws and policies in the U.S. versus mm-hmm. in the U.K. I know in the U.S., you know, there's this whole idea behind the First Amendment, and, you know, you never disrupt freedom of speech because where do you draw the line?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the question. Like, even if you can decide what is and what does and does not incite violence, where do you draw the line?
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder your thoughts on, in terms of developing censorship or methods of policing the internet, sort of who comes together to decide what is and is not potentially violent inciting.
Absolutely. It's an excellent question, and one at the very heart of this issue, actually, and I think one at the heart of what will emerge out from conversations that are only really just starting when looking at how we need to be thinking through extremist content online. On one level, absolutely, the freedom of expression side of CVE has to always be on the table. I think civil liberties is certainly always a question that we have to bear in mind in anything that we do and under this vast umbrella of work. But on the other hand, we know that content online is directly inciting and encouraging individuals to take up acts of terrorism, and the phrase lone wolf has been quite indicative of that. So where you have recipes of how to make a bomb in the kitchen of your mom advertised in Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine years ago, you know, these are things that are only more prevalent online. And there is a ready-made audience of individuals who are being recruited in a number of ways through one-to-one contact as well as being exposed to propaganda online. So on one level, that's the threat. We know the scale of the experiences, and we know the scale of individuals online who are subject to those types of risks. On the other side of the coin, you also have, I think, a danger of simplifying the internet and thinking that actually we can take down content outside of user-based platforms and platforms doing that themselves. So social media platforms have a strong user agreement, and they're already taking down lots of different content, whether or not it's explicit nudity, whether or not it's explicit porn. It doesn't really matter where on the continuum. They have quite a robust system in place, and governments are trying to encourage those organizations to take more stringent steps. But saying that, the problem's not going to go away. Content is held, and the way the internet works is that servers duplicate content on a very, very high profile basis. So when somebody starts a website up in London, it will be held on a server somewhere in the Middle East, somewhere in South and Southeast Asia. Content spreads so quickly that actually getting to the source of it is quite problematic. So I'd be interested to see what solutions are going to be proposed. But certainly outside of platforms themselves making up their own rules, I think governments are quite got their hands tied behind their backs in many respects because they can't control the global geographies that the internet operates in. And that poses significant problems. But I do think when I think about content online that should be taken down, I think most strongly around some of the Daesh videos that emerged, particularly last summer. And I think if a young child was to see them, we're in a position now where videos automatically play on Twitter or on Facebook. And when you have content like that going around, I do think we've got to do something. I just don't know quite what that something is. And I'm hoping that the social media platforms themselves will hopefully decide together. And I think that's the only way we can really move forward if they take up quite a robust way of saying amongst their own rights and their own users, and maybe through a consultation, what they think the right way is. But we're never going to please everybody.
What about the role of internet providers?
Absolutely. Well, this is the other side of the coin. So I think social media platforms are much more advanced in this in these discussions. But internet providers, ISPs, I think they have certainly already, they already manipulate what we see. They already use cookies to try and showcase, or we have cookies on our computers that will give us biased search engine results. If you Google your own name, it will look different on your laptop than it does on anybody else's in the world. You know, like, so there is already a manipulation taking place on what we can and cannot see. And I don't know whether or not we would suggest that they should have significant steps in place to try and reduce what the top ranking hits are when you Google things like ISIS, if you Google things like white power. And I don't know whether or not that's the correct thing to do, but I certainly think some of the counter responses that are taking place online are around using targeted advertisements. So when somebody searches for how do I get to Syria, that they're given an alternative view. And I think that in itself is quite an effective way of keeping the internet quite free and open, but also offering people guidance and another point of view that they wouldn't necessarily get if they hop on a closed forum for Daesh aspirers.
So in the beginning of your talk, I believe that you said that by and large, neo-Nazi groups are not officially considered extremist or terrorist groups by many organizations. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if there was any deliberate and extensive work being done to rectify this and to shift the narrative from, you know, considering quote-unquote radical Islamic groups mm-hmm. as being the, you know, the epitome of terrorism.
Absolutely. I would say if you all, those of you with laptops, look up the Southern Poverty Law Center based in the US, they have been campaigning for many, many years to try and get the balance right. And they are significant followers of neo-Nazi groups operating en masse in some states in the US. And they encourage civil society groups and communities to report the hate that they're expressing. And they map groups in a way to try and share that data with law enforcement to create a quicker reaction to an issue that often is bottom of the list. But certainly there are groups that are lobbying, and in terms, just for some clarity, the prescribed list of terrorist groups by the US and British governments are what I was referring to. And I certainly can advocate for that till the cows come home, but I think, you know, if anybody was interested in starting up a little campaign following this talk, I'd certainly sign it.
Thanks so much.
So you said the main cause of extremism was more political than religious. Okay, maybe there was a poor paraphrasing of, but it seemed to me that the
identity,
political side to it,
personally.
Identity, okay. Yeah. But doesn't religion have a crucial role in this as well? Because the religion is very political, and religion is a lot about identity in terms of the way it legitimizes hierarchies. Say, look at the caste system in Hinduism, or if you take any of the Abrahamic religions, you know, the way you have one God and everyone else is an unbeliever. It's incredibly problematic. And the way it legitimizes violence as well in many holy texts. I mean, when you take an action and say it is divinely legitimated, I mean, no one can argue with that. You can't disprove that. So, I mean, shouldn't challenging religion as well be quite a big role in what you do?
Absolutely. So we do have a very pronounced scholar who works at the Institute who does precisely that and works on the theological, ideological responses to so-called Islamist extremism. But I personally think that we frame religion when we're talking about radicalization in very dangerous ways. Religion is used as a vehicle for recruitment. It's manipulated to make political narratives and to make political aspirations come true. So, for example, if we look at the number of scholars from all parts of the world who've come out to condemn the use of theology by ISIS or by Al-Qaeda, I mean, even Al-Qaeda don't like ISIS, it says quite a lot. But if we're looking at those rebuttals that take place, they are en masse. So what you see is a political application of the religion being used as a recruitment tool. And I personally don't think we should call that religion, but absolutely is one of many factors, and it's key to someone's identity in many respects. But I do take issue with the treatment of so-called religious extremism that sometimes isn't used when we think of the Ku Klux Klan. They are religious extremists, you know, they're Christian extremists, but we never use that phrase. If we're thinking about some of the movements taking place in other parts of the world, I mean, like the Indian caste system is very interesting. If we're thinking about deaths that are committed as a result of people who buy into the caste system in India, particularly those at the bottom ranks, why are we not calling that terrorism? Surely that is terrorism too. And this is where I think some of the continuum around whether or not religion should be used in our definitions I think is wrong. But is it a driving force? Not exclusively by itself. At the center of that is identity, and whether somebody needs something more than they're getting from life, I think it's more about significance. And the dangerous thing is when you mix those things together and the toxic cocktail that so-called religious groups have done. So yeah, absolutely. It's a very good point to raise. I hope that's answered you okay.
So you spoke about de-radicalization. Is there any information about how kind of quote-unquote long it takes to de-radicalize someone? And if so, how long would it take?
It's the same way in as other is equipped to the same way out. It's very individual. The most interesting example of de-radicalization is one of the individuals who is a part of our Formers network. He's an imam. He was a former foreign fighter. He fought in Bosnia, in fact. And his pathway out of extremism was through a blood transfusion from a white person. And that was enough for him to have that seed of doubt saying, hang on, if I'm a part of a race that I feel so much hatred towards, if that race has somehow saved me, how can I possibly think that I can carry on down this path? And that was enough to poke the seed of doubt in him. And I think that's probably the quickest example that I know. But certainly I know of individuals who work in particularly the UK's Channel program, where that's taken a long time, many years for somebody to feel that they are, for the people working with them to feel that they're no longer in that high-risk category. But there are individuals, for example, a few cases I've had, some of the toughest cases I've had have been children of parents who have fled to join Daesh or who are in prison for killing somebody in the name of a white neo-Nazi group, who are always going to be slightly more vulnerable to those narratives. Individuals who've been raised maybe in training camps, who have been raised watching videos that propose a propaganda of hate on the world. And I think individuals who fall into that category, I've kind of been advocating for them to always have some kind of support. But it shouldn't be through DRAD. It should be, I think de-radicalization works best when it's dealing specifically with ideology. And if it's not dealing with that ideology head on in a challenging way, say, for example, rebutting theological interpretations of violence, it's not really DRAD. It's actually just our frontline social services. It's mental health responses. It's looking at social services responses. It's looking at improving somebody's life outcomes, sometimes looking at housing, sometimes looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. What is missing in that? And that's maybe not quite DRAD, and that work should never stop.
Okay, it's going to be a double-barrel question, but I'll make it very quick. Based on the assertion that CVE movements are best led by non-government actors, do you think that there is a role for a government in the CVE movement, if any? And what will be the place of legislation in all of this? Because some governments have tried to put in place anti-terrorism legislation, although this has been mostly controversial. Thank you.
Good questions and good points to end on. I do think governments have a role in CVE, not only from a position of reforming legislation to work more favourably for individuals on the ground. So, for example, considering when law enforcement mechanisms are encouraging a sense of injustice in communities, and I think that can be quite broadly applied in many parts of the world. And I also think that they need to facilitate and enable actors to come to the table who might be out of reach. So, for example, the government are credible to a number of different actors in the UK. If we're thinking particularly around, say, internet service providers, for example, you know, the government are key to bringing them to the table to reform parts of their service, but they're not necessarily the best ones to deliver the work, but they can facilitate the conversation in a way that charities like myself often can't. In terms of legislation, I think anti-terrorism legislation is always required in a country that has significant threats from terrorism. So if we're thinking about, in particular, countries, I'm trying to think. If you take Tunisia and you're looking at, say, some of the pre-Arab Spring movements taking place, you can see how a country that's incredibly prone to, to losing stability in all aspects of its government structures, its community structures. If you think of Somalia and if you think of Cameroon, in particular Boko Haram, I know a good friend of mine's a mayor in Cameroon and gets kidnapped on a regular basis by Boko Haram. Luckily, they're illegal, but that actually isn't doing anything. So you have anti-terrorism laws that are in place, and they are a necessity. But I don't think necessarily that they're considering the non-law enforcement aspects of this work, and I'm hoping that as we move forward in CVE in general, that there will be a commitment on a broader level than there is today of governments around the table recognising that law enforcement solutions actually could be quite counterproductive.
Okay, thank you very much for coming to talk to us, and thank you for your question and a good discussion.